It's great to be here with you. I've been looking forward to our time together for quite a while now. Although, Pete, I got to say, I love and respect you. I think you're one of the best leaders of our generation, like across the world. And I love this church. I love what God is doing here. But I think this is my third time teaching here. When do I get to use the real pulpit? What, do I have to be Anglican or something? Like, why am I stuck with a music stand down here on the dirty carpet? But whatever. Other than that, it's really great to be with you. I'm from Portland, Oregon, which is a part of the world where we have this thing called summer. And apparently you don't have that here. But other than that, it's really great to be with you. And honest to God, I really love your community. I learn so much every time I'm here from you, from what God is stirring up in you and your city, and what a great part of town. So all that to say, it's really a joy to be with you. And I just want to talk to you a little bit out of my own life story in my apprenticeship, or if you prefer the language of discipleship, to Jesus of Nazareth. So if you have a Bible, turn to Matthew chapter 11. If you don't, feel free to just sit there and feel guilty. That's fine too. There's a long history in the Western church of guilt and shame, so we're happy to tap into that. But if you want, turn to Matthew chapter 11 in your Bible, or if you have an app on your phone. And I just want to read to you a little teaching of Jesus of Nazareth. It's only a few lines long, that my guess is, if you grew up in the church, you know this like the back of your hand, but I think there's a lot in here that we miss. Matthew chapter 11, take a look down at the very end of the chapter at verse 28. "Come to me," this is Jesus here, "all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you," what? "Rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls," not just your body, your souls, "for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Let me reread that teaching over you, but this time around from a paraphrase of the New Testament by Eugene Peterson. Most of you know it. It's called The Message. Just listen to his paraphrase. "Are you tired, worn out, burned out on religion? Come to me, get away with me, and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace." How good is that line? "I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me, and you'll learn to live freely and lightly." This is an invitation to all of the tired in the room. Anybody out there? All of the stressed out, all of those behind on your to-do list. Anybody else like that? This is London. Let me rephrase the question. Is there anybody not like that in the room tonight? In the modern world, in a year like 2017, wherever you live, but especially if you live in a global city like London, have Wi-Fi access or a smartphone in your back pocket, the vast majority of us live with a low-grade anxiety and nonstop fatigue that we think this is just the way it is. 2017, the digital age, I have a demanding job or I'm a student or whatever. This is just the way it is. But what if it doesn't have to be this way? What if there's an invitation on offer from Jesus of Nazareth, a rabbi and more from the first century down to today, to an unhurried life in relationship with the God that he called Father? I don't know about you, but for me, that sounds so good. But let's just call out the elephant in the room. When I read this passage, I read this for years growing up in the church, and I would come to this little paragraph, and I would think to myself, honestly, I can't relate to it. Any of you feel that way? Any of you read this, and if you're ruthlessly honest with yourself and with God, you think, that doesn't make sense. I am tired. I am a little bit burned out on religion. If you're a pastor, it's an occupational hazard. Am I missing something? That's how I read this for a very long time. Honest to God, am I missing something? Because this does not describe in language my felt experience of apprenticeship to Jesus. Now, if you've been around the church for any length of time, if you grew up in the church or whatever, the odds are that you already know this teaching of Jesus. It's practically a cliche. So we have this thing in America. I'm not sure if you have it, but I grew up in the 80s, and so like there was this thing where grandmothers back in the 80s and 90s would cross-stitch Bible verses. Did you have that? And then frame it up, like little one-liners, and then frame them up, and usually they made it to the bathroom or something like that. Is that just an American? We have some ugly, bad art in America. That's all I have to say. This was like a favorite of grandmas in bathrooms all over the United States of America through the 80s and 90s. This come to me, all you are wearing, you're washing up before dinner or whatever. And the danger with a line like that is you think you know what Jesus is saying, but often it goes right over our head. Hidden in plain sight in this teaching right in front of you from the end of Matthew 11 is what the philosopher Dallas Willard called the secret of the easy yoke. There's a really good idea here I want to unpack for you. He writes this: in this truth, the one that we just read out of Matthew, lies the secret of the easy yoke. The secret involves living as Jesus lived in the entirety of his life, adopting his overall lifestyle. Our mistake is to think that following Jesus consists in loving our enemies, going the second mile, turning the other cheek, that's all stuff from the Sermon on the Mount, suffering patiently and hopefully, while living the rest of our lives just as everyone else around us does. That is a strategy bound to fail. What he's saying here is simple but profound, and here's my paraphrase of the secret of the easy yoke. If you want to experience the life of Jesus, you have to adopt the lifestyle of Jesus. Let me say that again. If you want to experience the life of Jesus, you have to adopt the lifestyle of Jesus. I live right on the edge of downtown Portland, which is up in the Pacific Northwest, and it's not as large as London, but it's a beautiful urban center. And we were lucky enough to get this old house right on the edge of downtown. And across the street from our house is another home that has, I think, 6 single people living in it, which is very Portland-esque. And they all, so Nike is based in Portland, and so a ton of people in our church work for Nike. It's one of the largest employers in town. And I think either all 6 people work for Nike, or they're sponsored by Nike, or they're something, because they're essentially like a walking advertisement for all things Nike. And there's, on a regular basis, they're all runners, right? So I run, but I'm not a runner. You know what I mean by the difference between the two? Like, I run 4 days a week, but I'm not a runner, all right? It's a whole other thing. So on a regular basis, I wake up in the morning, and I have my Bible there and my coffee, and I'm there just with Jesus and my Chemex, and I look out that front window, and I see them at dark 30 in the morning, right in the middle of winter sometimes, walk out of that front door, and they all just look right out of a Runner's World magazine advertisement. They're all wearing, you know, tights, and they just look amazing in tights. And like 2% body fat, and they have everything and all the gadget, all the gear. And then they go, and it's less running, and it's more like, they're less antelope, more and less human, more antelope. You know, it's less running and more like prancing just down the street. At 6 minute mile, I'm just so fast. And on a regular basis, I sit there with my coffee and my, you know, sweatshirt on, and I think, I want that life. I want to look amazing in spandex. I want 2% body fat. I want to be able to run a 6 minute mile anytime I want. But then I start to think about the lifestyle that's behind that life. So like I stayed up late with a glass of red wine and Netflix, and they like had celery and water for dinner and went to bed at 8:30, you know? I'm sitting here with my coffee in the morning, reading, and they're out in the freezing cold of winter, like, running. When I run, I, like, podcast Pete or listen to a TED Talk or something like that. And I just, like, kind of, you know, jog, get like, work off a few calories. They run, as in run. And I think, man, am I really willing to pay the price, to make the sacrifice that is necessary to experience that kind of life? And so I think a lot, I say that because I think a lot of us feel that way about Jesus of Nazareth. We read a story or 2 or 20 in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, these 4 first century gospels or biographies of Jesus. And I'm guessing that if you're in the room tonight, you find Jesus of Nazareth compelling. Either that or you find a man or a woman to your right or to your left compelling, and they find Jesus compelling. So I'm not here to judge your motivation, all right? That's Pete's problem, not mine. So I'm just happy you're here. But I'm guessing that the vast majority of you at some level find Jesus compelling. And it's easy to feel that way about Jesus. Oh, I want that life that Jesus has on offer. That famous line, I have come that you might have life and life to the full. And you think, yes, there's a deep like resonance with that at a soul level. But then you realize, oh, that life is the byproduct of a lifestyle. Now, by lifestyle, I mean the rhythms and routines and rituals that make up your day-to-day existence, the way that you spend the resources of your time and your money. Your life is the byproduct of all of that. In business parlance, if you work in the marketplace, there's that little one-liner, your system is perfectly designed to give you the results you are getting. Meaning, if the results you are getting are, you are tired, you are worn out, you are burned out on religion, if that's the results that you're getting, if you are stressed out and you feel this low-grade anxiety that rarely, if ever, goes away and you can't really calm down at a soul level, if that's the results that you are getting, then the odds are is that your system is perfectly designed to give you that end. Something about your life, something about the system that is your morning routine, your weekend rhythm, your day-to-day existence, your job, your life, your relationship to your phone, community or lack thereof, something about it is perfectly designed to give you that byproduct. And what we need to get back to is lifestyle. You know, there's an idea that I think in the Western church, whether you're in England or America or anywhere in Europe, I think we've lost sight of after the Reformation. It's that the way of Jesus is just that. It is a way of life. It's not just a set of ideas, or what we call the Bible and theology. It's not just a list of do's and don'ts, or what we call ethics or a moral vision. It is that, and that's beautiful, but it's so much more. It's also a way of life. It's a whole lifestyle based on the life and the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. And I think in the church, at least in my tradition, we say a lot about kind of the Bible and theology, a lot about ethics, but very little about lifestyle. But lifestyle, I would argue, is where the money is at. And that's what Jesus is getting at with this kind of odd imagery. It's an agrarian metaphor that's lost in the 21st century urban world, but of the easy yoke. I love this from Frederick Dale Bruner. He's a top scholar on the Gospel of Matthew, just brilliant kind of academic. And he writes this. It's a little bit dense, but it's worth it, so just pay close attention. He writes that a yoke is a work instrument. Thus, when Jesus offers a yoke, he offers what we might think tired workers need least. They need a mattress or a vacation, not a yoke. I love that. But Jesus realizes that the most restful gift he can give the tired is a new way to carry life, a fresh way to bear responsibilities. Realism sees that life is a succession of burdens. We cannot get away from them. Thus, instead of offering escape, Jesus offers equipment. Jesus means that the obedience to the Sermon on the Mount, his yoke, and by the way, yoke was a first century metaphor for a rabbi's set of teachings, his way of reading Torah, his way of reading a whole new way to be human, right? So Jesus means that obedience to his Sermon on the Mount, his yoke, will develop us in a balance and a way of carrying life that will give more rest than the way we have been living. There is an emotional weight to life, would you agree? Whether you live in a city like London or out in a rural countryside, whether you have a family of three or you're single, whether you have a demanding profession or you're in between jobs right now or still searching for what's next, it doesn't matter. There is an emotional weight to life. Why do you think there's so much addiction in our society? Whether it is addiction to technology or social media or substance abuse or work or sexuality, what are people looking for? People are looking for an escape from the emotional weight that we all carry. There is no such thing as an easy life. That is a myth. But there is such a thing as an easy yoke. And what Jesus is saying with this beautiful imagery of an easy yoke is, if you think about a yoke, it was almost always used to tie two animals together in order to shoulder a load, two oxen or two donkey out in a field for a farmer. Jesus is saying, listen, hey, come alongside me, tuck in right shoulder to shoulder, take my yoke upon you, let me do all the heavy lifting, you just keep pace with me, just don't run ahead, don't fall behind, you just keep pace with me, let me do all the heavy lifting, and and we'll do this thing called life together. That's what Jesus is saying here. Now, there's just one problem, or at least there's probably all sorts of problems, but there's just one that I want to take on with you guys tonight, and that is this. For the vast majority of you in the room, myself included, to take up the easy yoke of Jesus means that you have to slow down. If there's anything that you get from reading the four Gospels, is that Jesus was pretty much never in a hurry. So he was busy, like basically he would wake up in the morning, pray, and then like go do amazing stuff until bedtime. So his schedule was chock full. Like you don't read about Jesus catching up on, you know, The People versus O.J. Simpson on Netflix or whatever. And like he's just not out, you know, to see Dunkirk that weekend or whatever. Like his life was chock full. Yet at the same time, he never comes off hurried. You never read about Jesus curt or in a rush, or I'm sorry I don't have time for you, or I'd pray for you, but I need to catch a flight down to Jerusalem or whatever. I have a great speaking gig tomorrow morning. Or like, can you imagine Jesus like kind of the millennial half talking to you, half texting back somebody, Like, I just don't think that. For some reason, I just don't think Jesus would have a phone for that matter. He'd just be like, I'll just pray really hard. But my point is, when you read the stories about Jesus, you realize that in spite of the fact that his life was really full, it was busy, but it was not over busy, and he was never really in a hurry. In fact, you read that he would spend a lot of time alone. He would, on a regular basis, get up early in the morning and slip out to a quiet place to pray. He would even head out a stone's throw away from his little, from his group of friends, from his apprentices in the Garden of Gethsemane, just to process his feelings with God. He spent a lot of time sleeping. We forget that. Like, there's more than one story where his disciples have to wake him up like halfway through the morning. I like this Jesus. I like the idea of apprenticeship. I want to become like him as I grow older. He would Sabbath. He set aside an entire day. Think about this. Jesus set aside an entire day of the week to do nothing but rest and worship. That's fascinating right there. To think, well, I don't really need that. Well, Jesus did. I'm guessing that you and I do well. He lived very simply, just the clothes on his back. You don't read about him out shopping at the market in Jerusalem and all the discontent and distraction that comes from materialism. All that to say, Jesus put on a very specific kind of life on display, and it's an unhurried life that all of you are invited to in your apprenticeship to Jesus. John Ortberg, you may or may not know him, is a writer and a pastor, one of the best Bible teachers, in my opinion, of the generation before me. And recently, I got the privilege to share a meal with him. And I rarely fanboy out, like, you know, we millennials think we're too cool for that. But man, I was like all fanboy. I was like nervous on the drive there and like had my notepad with all my questions all ready to go. And like, I'm kind of socially awkward and introverted. And so I like had to work myself up for it. And I wanted to record the conversation, but then I thought, that's a little creepy. Let's not do that. And so we sat down to have lunch, and he was just everything I dreamed he would be. And it was just, you ever hang out with people that are a few decades older than you? I think he's maybe late 60s. And just think to yourself, I want to be that when I grow up. That's the kind of man or woman that I want to grow and mature into in apprenticeship to Jesus. And even, well, that's the kind of transformation that's possible with Jesus of Nazareth over a long period of time. Anyway, we sit down to have lunch, and he was a mentee of Dallas Willard, who's just this, his writings have shaped me in a really deep way. And he was a mentee for, I think, 20 years, and Willard died a few years ago. And so I was just, like, asking him stories, like, tell me stories about 20 years with Dallas Willard. I mean, for me, that's, like, with practically with the Apostle Paul or something, you know? Tell me stories. And he told me this one story that I just can't stop thinking about. He said that in the late 90s, Ortberg at the time was the teaching pastor at Willow Creek Community Church in Chicago, which in the late 90s, once again, most of you don't realize this, but it was, my guess is, the most influential church in the Western world. Ortberg himself was a best-selling author, world-famous Bible teacher, so on and so forth. The kind of person that you look to and say, okay, that guy has it all together. But he actually was at a really unhealthy place in his soul and was starting to lose a bit of his soul working at a mega church and felt like he was stuck in his transformation, like he could not or would not or whatever move forward and grow and mature. And so he calls up Willard, who's in California, calls up Willard and says, all right, I'm stuck. What am I missing? I feel like this church thing is draining my soul out. What do I need to do to break free and move forward? And he said there's a long silence on the other end. end of the line. And then he said, with Willard, there was almost always a long silence. And then Willard said two lines. This is it. First, he said, you must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. Deep breath. Then he said this, hurry is the great enemy of spiritual life in our day. Ortberg, of course, wrote that down. It's like before Twitter or the internet would have broke or something. But he wrote that down. Oh my gosh, that's amazing. He said, all right, that was so good. Thank you. What else? What else is there? And then he said, there was another long pause. And then Willard said, there is nothing else. That was literally the end of the conversation. I think that is fascinating because if I were to ask you, prior to that story, if I were to ask you, hey, what do you think the greatest challenge is in following Jesus or in a church life in 2017 in a city like London? Like, what's the greatest challenge you face? What would you say? I don't know. Maybe you would say, you know, progressive theology or the debate and controversy around sexuality right now or marriage. Or maybe you'd say the widening gap between the rich and the poor or Brexit or politics. Or I don't know what you would say. My guess is that very few, if any of us, would say, you know what it is? It's hurry. Like, that's at the top of the list. That's the number one challenge that I face living in a city like London in a year like 2017 as an apprentice of Jesus. But I think he's really on to something. Satan doesn't always show up like with a pitchfork on Will Ferrell's shoulder or whatever. Like, often, what if he shows up just as much or more so as the dopamine rush that you get from your phone or another hour at the office on a weekend? Or in commitment after commitment after commitment, or in a life of speed. It's been said that if the devil can't make you sin, he'll make you busy, because they both accomplish essentially the exact same thing. The famous psychologist Carl Jung, who developed the idea of introverts and extroverts, that's his language. His work, as most of you know, is the basis for the Myers-Briggs personality test. And he had this great little one-liner. He said, hurry isn't of the devil, it is the devil. When I was running, we spent the last few years kind of re-architecting and rebuilding our church around discipleship and kind of transformation into the image of Jesus. And when I was about to kind of launch this whole new campaign, is not the right word, but kind of new vision with our church, I sat down for a few hours with my therapist, who is this PhD, brilliant 67-year-old Jesus guy that I just adore, kind of like the Obi-Wan Kenobi of the Kingdom of God or something like that. And I ran the whole idea by him, and a lot of it even was the byproduct of our time together over the years. And he kept saying this one line to me, I think three times in our conversation. He said, the number one problem that you will face is time. People are just too busy to live emotionally healthy and spiritually awake and alive. So here's a PhD who for 40 years or something has been in therapy. He said, the number one problem is time. People just don't actually have the margin to go live and live well. Michael Zigarelli from the Charleston University School of Business did a survey of 20,000 Christians. This is in the U.S., so it's probably even worse here. That was kind of a, like, sarcastic. You don't laugh at anything. I even mock you and you don't even laugh. Well, my goodness. All right. Well, okay. Sorry. Just don't invite me back. I'm not coming back without the pulpit anyway, you know? He did this fascinating survey, 20,000 Christians, and my guess is this is just as true here, and he identified busyness as the number one distraction from life with God. Listen to his summary of the survey. Quote, it may be the case that, one, Christians are assimilating a culture of busyness, hurry, and overload, which leads to, two, God becoming more marginalized in Christians' lives, which leads to, three, a deteriorating relationship with God, which leads to, four, Christians becoming even more vulnerable to adopting secular assumptions about how to live, which leads to, five, more conformity to a culture of busyness, hurry, and overload, and then the cycle begins again. Anybody recognize that? And pastors, by the way, he said, are the worst, right up there with doctors and lawyers. Not this pastor, but the Pete's down here or somebody like that, you know. Have a look at this from Ronald Rollheiser, who's a Catholic writer that I adore all of his material. He writes this, today a number of historical circumstances are blindly flowing together and accidentally conspiring to produce a climate within which it is difficult not just to think about God or to pray, but simply to have any interior depth whatsoever. We are distracting ourselves into spiritual oblivion. Pathological busyness, distraction, and restlessness are major blocks today within our spiritual lives. We are distracting ourselves into spiritual oblivion. So you see, what is at stake here is not just your emotional health, right? This is not just, hey, if you want to not be so stressed out, you need to slow down. No, what's at stake here is even more, it's life or death. Your spiritual life is at stake. Because if you don't slow down to tap back into the, quote, rhythms of grace, then something will fracture in you at a soul level and break your connection to God, to other people, and to your own soul. I can't help but wonder if Jesus would say to our entire generation what he said to Martha, "You are worried and distracted about so many things, but one thing is necessary." I think the need of the hour is for a slow down spirituality. We all know, of course, that the world has sped up to this frenetic pace. I did a little research on this, and I found it fascinating. So the clock was actually invented by followers of Jesus. It was invented by the monks and used to organize the monastery around fixed hour prayer. But historians don't point to that, rather to 1370 as a turning point in Western Europe, which was the year that the first public clock was set up in Cologne, Germany. And historians point to this little moment, which we think of as a blip on the timeline, as a turning point because it marked a shift in Western Europe from artificial time, from natural time to artificial time. So time used to be natural, meaning you woke up when the sun came up in the morning, and you went to sleep when it went down, and days were longer in the summer, which is a thing you don't know about, and shorter in the winter, which is a thing you do know about. And there was like a rhythm to life, right? There was winter, there was summer, there was harvest, all of that. But artificial time is now the 9 to 5, or if you live in London, the 7 to 7, or whatever it is. It's the slog of morning rush hour commute all year long. Then, of course, in 1879, you have Thomas Edison and the light bulb, which cut way back on our sleep time. So I read this recently, and I like had to triple read it to make sure I was not reading it wrong, that in America, prior to the light bulb, prior to Edison, the average American, middle of the bell curve, slept 11 to 11 and a half hours a night. Just think about that. So like I used to read these biographies of like great men of God or women of God from hundreds of years ago, and they would get up at 4 a.m. to pray, and I used to think it was so amazing because they went to bed at 7, all right? They still got more sleep than I did and woke up to pray for 4 hours. Of course, what else would you do? It was dark outside and you can only sleep for so long. So now, I mean, we literally think about that. The average American I know sleeps about 7 hours a night. I'm guessing it's the same here. Then about a century ago, technology started to change our relationship to time with so-called labor-saving devices. So we used to, in order to stay warm in winter, used to have to, like, go out into the forest and risk your life. There was, like, a bear or something out there. You had an axe and cut down a tree and then, like, cut it up and chop it and make a fire. Now all you do is, like, if you have a new flat, you just, like, open the app on your phone and, like, move your thumb up a little bit and heat just comes up through the floor. Maybe it's old school and you have to turn a dial. Like heat, I don't know where it comes from, but heat just comes up out of the floor. My point is, in spite of our dishwasher and laundry machine and toaster and microwave, we all feel like we have less time, not more. So all these social theorists in the 1960s, from sci-fi writers to political and economic theorists, were writing about the future, and everybody was on the same page. Everybody thought that we would have all this leisure on our hands. One famous Senate subcommittee in 1967 said that by 1985, the average American would only work 22 hours a week for 27 weeks a year. Now, that is true in France, but everywhere else, it's, can I say that here? Is that a little offensive? Just a little offensive is good. A lot offensive is bad. But but leisure time across the West has actually decreased 37%. So the question is, where did all that extra time go? And the answer is we spent it on other things. Over the same time period, you see the death of Sabbath, which for our generation, at least mine, I don't remember Sunday as a Sabbath day, but my dad, who's 67, still tells stories about growing up in the 50s and how the entire city, we lived in Silicon Valley in California, the entire city would just shut down for an entire day a week, and most people were in church. Like, I can't even fathom a world in which that was true. Now, of course, all of this reached a climax, I'm coming to an end here, in 2007 with the release of the iPhone into the wild. So, like, 2007, when the history books are written, will be just as key of an inflection point in world history, not just Western European history, as 1440. 1440, of course, was the year that Gutenberg invented the printing press, which launched the Protestant Reformation, as well as the Enlightenment, which transformed Europe, and out of that, the world. 2007 was the year that we all became addicted to a little screen in our back pocket. And it was also the year of a whole bunch of other technological breakthroughs, such as Facebook and Twitter and the cloud and the app store. It was the official start date of the digital age. And in every survey I read, people had no idea just how much time we, for the most part, spend on our smartphone or online. I read a recent study that said the average iPhone user touches their phone 2,617 times a day. They are on their phone for 2.5 hours over 76 sessions. That's average. If you just factor in millennials, it was twice that, over 5 hours a day. Now, my point is to say, something is deeply wrong with our culture. We have sped up to this crazy, frenetic, go, go, go pace, especially in a city like London, but pretty much anywhere you live. Psychologists and mental health professionals are now talking about hurry sickness, which is, quote, a behavior pattern characterized by continual rushing and anxiousness. I read one psychologist who had three symptoms of hurry sickness. Here they are. You ready for this? Number one, like you can just self-diagnose here. It's really easy. Number one, you move from one checkout line to another because it's shorter. You know who you are, right? Number two, I don't know if you have a car in London, but like, just use your imagination. When you come to a stoplight, you count the cars ahead of you and change lanes. Anybody? Yeah, you know you do. You're quiet because you feel guilty. Number three, you multitask to the point that you forget one of the tasks. Not to play armchair psychologist, but I'm pretty sure that we all have hurry sickness. And hurry, on a much more serious note, is a form of violence to the soul. Ruth Haley Barton, I really love some of her work, and she has these 10 signs that you're moving too fast through life. And let me just read them over you. This is all her language, not mine. Number one, irritability. So like you're quick to just lose your temper, or even if it's not like yell and scream at people, you're just quick to snap at people, especially if you're a parent or with a coworker or a roommate or a spouse. You're just quick, you're just on edge. Number two is hypersensitivity. It's just so easy for you to like get offended or mad at this little thing or the other. Number three is restlessness. When you finally actually do carve out time to take a day off or give Sabbath a shot or take a few hours to just go read at the park or sleep and go to bed early, you can't calm down. You can't rest. You've sped up to this pace and you don't even know what to do with yourself. And you almost feel more anxious when you try to rest than when you are busy. Number four is compulsive overworking. You just can't stop. Number five is emotional numbness. You just lose the capacity, in particular for things like empathy. You're sitting with somebody who's suffering and you lose that emotional, you don't have margin. You don't have enough space in your mind or in your heart to feel with other people. Number six is escapist behaviors. We just like start binge watching Netflix or you're on social media all the time. We're like, you can't stop Instagram story or whatever your thing is or whatever your escapist behavior of choice is. Number seven is we end up disconnected from our identity and calling. We get sucked into the tyranny of the urgent and we're so go, go, go and busy with work and school and friends and this and that and church and the other that we wake up one day and we realize I'm not even living out of who I am and who I'm not, what I'm called to do, what I'm not called to do. Months go by or years go by or God forbid a lifetime goes by and we realize I never even got to the things that I claimed were the most important things in my life. Because I just got sucked into it. I got off track with so many other things. Number eight, not able to attend to human needs, sleeping enough at night, maybe not 11 hours, but eight. Exercise, diet, all of like just Sabbath, healthy soul stuff. Number nine, hoarding energy. Like you just hold it back because you have so little. It's like a precious commodity. And then of course, number 10, and I think at the top of the list is slippage in spiritual practices. What happens is when we get overtired, and out of that, when we get over busy, we actually don't have, this is a weird, weird catch-22, we don't have the emotional or even spiritual energy to do what's actually life-giving for our soul. Because in a weird twist, some of the things that are the most life-giving for your soul actually require some discipline, especially in the digital age. even require a little bit of emotional energy. Think of prayer. Like that's so life-giving for the soul, but it takes a little bit. Sabbath, it actually takes quite a bit of self-discipline in a city like London or Portland in a year like 2017 to set aside a whole day to rest and worship. When we don't have that kind of margin at a soul level, all we really have time for is like escapist behavior. So we veg out, we watch TV, we go with friends, we see another movie. That's all we have capacity for. And so we don't ever get the rest we need at a soul level. And the very things that make for life, what the ancient followers of Jesus called the spiritual disciplines, these habits based on the life of Jesus, like the very, like where the life actually is, we just don't even have. Those are the first things to go. Not about you, but the first time I read this was maybe a year ago, and I was like 7 for 10, and I just thought, oh, dang, this is not a test. Like, you don't have to score yourself, but hopefully you don't fail like I did or whatever. My point is, we have a problem, and it's time, a relationship to time, but the solution, hear me, is not more time. And you all know this, you're smart thinking people, right? The solution's not more time. On a regular basis, I catch myself saying something like, I just wish there were 5 more hours in a day, or 10 more hours in a day, or 3 more days in a week. You ever like feel like that? That is so irrational. Like, the reality is, if the universe were to warp right now, and 10 more hours were added to every single day, what would we do? I know what I would do. I would just fill up those 10 hours with all the things that I don't get to right now. And then I would be even more exhausted than I am now. So the solution is not more time. The solution is to slow down our life and to simplify everything in us around the core elements of what really makes for a life done well. Around the spiritual disciplines, or what I prefer to call the practices of Jesus. To slow down, organize our life around the practices, and make what Jesus called abiding, whatever you want to call that, the practice of the presence of God, just this life of deep connection to God, to other people, and to your own soul, to make that the center point. Whatever it is that you do for a living or with your day, whether you're a vicar or a pastor or a full-time parent or a student or a creative or an entrepreneur or a CEO or an accountant or an educator, whatever it is that you do, to make the center point of all of it, breathe in, breathe out, life of deep connection to God and other people and my own soul, to make that the center. Now, there's all sorts of buzz about this in secular society right now, and I'm grateful for that. But followers of Jesus have been saying this for thousands of years. We have this deep, deep history in the spiritual disciplines, in the church, of a life of simplicity around what matters most. Our defining narrative, think of Genesis 1, says that we are made in the image of God, but we're also made from the dust. Think about the tension there. To be made in the image of God means that you are rife with potential to rule over the world in a life-giving way. But to be made from the dust means that you are mortal, not immortal. You are finite, not infinite. You are creation, not creator. You are human and not divine. And part of our apprenticeship to Jesus is learning to embrace both our potential and our limitations. We hear all the time to embrace our potential, and that's right and that's true. I believe in that. You're made in the image of God. Embrace your potential. What we don't hear barely ever at all inside the church or out of it is embrace your limitations. We all have limitations. We have emotional limitations. We have relational limitations. We have intellectual or educational limitations, all of us. One limitation that we all share, doesn't matter where you come from in the socioeconomic spectrum, doesn't matter your country of origin or family of origin or how many letters you have or don't have after your name. One limitation that we all share, equal playing field, is time. Nobody here has more than 24 hours a day. Not a single one of you. And we have to wrestle with our mortality in a culture that is working overtime to transgress time itself, to experience everything, to eat at every restaurant, have every new drink, go to every single country, experience every vacation, watch every TV show. There's now like TV anxiety. Now I have this thing, there's so much good TV now that when someone comes up to me like, oh, have you seen, you just said that, like, have you seen The Night Manager? I'm like, no, I have this instant anxiety. It's like another show I don't even know about, and now I need to watch that one too. And, well, it's one of the best British shows of all time. Like, oh, now I don't even have time for this. I'm like, my queue is so backed up. Like, this just me? Okay, that's just me. That's I guess it's an American entertainment culture thing. My point is there's this like fear of missing out and this YOLO and this sense like we have to get another stamp in the passport. We have, if it's out there, we have to experience it. No, we don't. We're human. We don't only live once, by the way, for followers of Jesus. That's a whole other side teaching, but that's not even true. We are human. We have to embrace our potential and our limitations, and we all share the limitation of time. We have to release that need to experience everything. We have to slow down, embrace our humanity, and make what matters most front and center in our life. What we're talking about here is what the ancient followers of Jesus called a rule of life. And rule has got a bit, that word's a bit of a turnoff to a lot of people. It's from a Greek word, though, that just meant trellis. Think of a vineyard. Think of Jesus teaching on abiding in the vine. A rule of life is the trellis. It's the system. It's the structure. It's the schedule of your life that makes abiding, and out of that makes fruit. Think of the fruit of the Spirit. If you've ever read that passage in the New Testament, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, that makes fruit. Like, that makes it all a reality in your life. Stephen Covey of 90s Daytimer fame said that we achieve inner peace when our schedule is aligned with our values. I think that Jesus would agree with that statement. If following Jesus, if the practices of the way of Jesus for slowing down, things, I'm out of time, but things like Sabbath, things like silence and solitude, things like simplicity, or what secular culture calls minimalism, just living simply, these ancient practices from the way, if they don't make it onto your, you call it a diary, right? That's what we call it, like when like 12-year-old girls write about boys. We call it a schedule. You don't call it a schedule, do you? If it doesn't make it onto your diary, it feels so weird to say that. It's not what it means for me. I don't have a diary. I don't think I should have a diary. But if it doesn't make it onto your diary, onto your schedule, onto your iCal, we all have that, right? Like the global language, Apple. If it doesn't make it there, then it will never work its way into the warp and the woof of your life. Now I'm done. I'm out of time. But I just want to say one last thing. It's such a joy to be with you. Please don't write me off. I know that there's a temptation, especially in a city like London, to just say, you know what, this city is so exhausting. And it is. I love your city. But wow, I can only take it for about a week, and then I need a vacation. You know, and I'm on vacation. That's not a good sign. I love your city so much, but it's exhausting. The pace of life here is just so go, how expensive it is, how small everything is, the noise, the traffic. And so I know it's so, the temptation is just to write me off. Yeah, that's fine. You don't know what you're talking about. Or that's fine, like when I'm older and I move away from London and I have a family and a boring job or something like that. But not right now, not for this stage of life. This is for now or it's not forever. And you're right, I don't know what it's like to live in London. But I live in a city. I'm raising 3 children. That's like 8 full-time jobs, all right? And I'm working a demanding job. I get it at least a little bit. And this is very much out of my journey. I hit a moment a few years ago in my early 30s where I was in a really unhealthy place on the inside. On the outside, I was a raging success by all the American metrics. But on the inside, it was not. And you get to the spot, some of you have already been there or en route, where you start to kind of reevaluate your life before you live it. And you start to envision yourself out a decade, 2, 3, 4 down the road. And it was terrifying. I did not like who I was becoming. And I realized, well, I can be a success on the outside and a miserable failure as a human being, as a husband, as a father, as an apprentice of Jesus. So I had to kind of reboot the whole system. And honestly, the last 3 years, which if this, I don't have time to talk about it, but has been a real transformative journey for me. The number one thing I've been working out with Jesus is just slowing down and spending more time in prayer and making abiding the center point of my life. And the more I do it, the longer I live, the more I think Willard was right. That's it. It's not that complex. Slow down. Pray more. And just be with Jesus all day long. Right in the middle of London, right in the middle of your career or your education, single, family, whatever your life is, just slow down. Take a deep breath. Make the practices of Jesus the center point. Just abide and watch. It won't happen overnight, but give it a little while. Give it a few years. Give it a few decades. Give it a lifetime, and you will become somebody extraordinary. Grace and peace to you guys.